It's time to talk about the outdoors in South Alabama. Hunting, fishing, and getting outside along the Great Gulf Coast. It's time to take it outside with FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. With reports, stories, how-to information, and Dr. Bill's Marine Forecast. Here's Sean Sullivan and Mike Ward.
All right, here we go. FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Glad to have y'all along. Captain Mike.
Captain Sean, how you doing?
Man, I'm making it. It's transition
time. You loser.
Yeah, I lost. You're the winner.
Loser.
Yeah, we were out at the Hunter's Night Out on Monday night out at G&D Farms, and the lucky hot streak hand of Mike Ward in the drawing that, you know, you get a ticket when you go into this event, and
yeah.
You get a ticket, and they drew down, and they drew through all the stuff that, I mean, they were all, and to go through. I mean, the stuff was good that Lee had out there, but some of the stuff was not as exciting as like the deer feeders and stuff. And it gets down to the end, right? And I've been sitting there. I'd gotten close to my number a couple times in the drawing.
One side of it, another side of it. Yeah, mine too.
And then they called Mike's number, and he went up there and got the deer feeder.
The grand prize.
I did win Rack Attack.
Yeah, you did win some Rack Attack. So
which that stuff, a whole side note, we'll talk about it as we get closer, because now baiting's legal in the state of Alabama. You buy that baiting license. You know, in the past, I've used that for my camera stations.
Sure.
And I've told you about that before, that, you know, I'd have a corn feeder somewhere with a camera on it and get a few bucks, but a bunch of does. I started running that Rack Attack stuff. Honestly, I've been doing it about 3 years now. 2 years? No, this will be 3 years. And it's like 50-50 bucks to do. I have never seen anything like it. I don't know. It's
Sean,
a rice brand
I've been
thing.
Using it too. I've been using it too.
And so do you agree?
I agree.
It brings, I don't know why, instead of it being like 90% does at a camera and 10% bucks, it's like 50-50.
Yeah. They love it. Absolutely love it. And what I did find with my Rack Attack, and I don't know why, but the hogs love to lay in and sleep in it. They do. It's like a bed or something. They'll come in there. And I'm not talking about just a couple pictures. I've got a ton of pictures of
laying
hogs coming. They come in there and go to sleep and lay in there for hours on that Rack Attack. Why they do that, I have no idea.
I don't know.
But we're going to have something. We're going to have a pen that we're going to.
Yeah,
we're gonna talk more about hogs later on about traps and everything. And here's another thing about let's talk about this real quick about the hog traps. Tony Hill was out there the other night at G&D, and he's got a hog trap that you put a camera on and it releases and the hog trap falls down.
Yeah, there's remote control traps,
right? And now they're like $6,000, but here's what everybody's got to know is the government will subsidize that 75%. So that $6,000, you end up paying $1,500 for the trap. So that's something that we're going to talk a lot about as we do more shows, because everybody needs to be able to get them a trap or two or three and put on their property. Maybe the traps would do something to help control the hogs. So I'm just going out and shooting a few here and there, or dogs running them and killing a few here and there, that ain't going to do it.
No,
it's going to be traps only.
I'm going to take a victory. I still hadn't had a chance to talk to Congressman Byrne, but I wonder if we go back and get the old podcast of when the Farm Bill passed.
Yes.
And Congressman Byrne was on the midday show, and he was talking about all the money he got for Alabama farmers to deal with hog issues. And I said, hey, instead of spending on this kind of program or that, why don't y'all subsidize some of these high-dollar hog traps?
Sean,
I'm just saying.
I bet you that's exactly what he did. He took your – had to have taken your idea – He wouldn't have known any of that.
I just looked at it from my perspective, and I don't know if they followed my lead or not on it, but
I guarantee you they did.
There's a lot of people that got hog issues that I tell you right now, clubs or individual landowners can't spend $6,000.
Or the other traps are $9,000 and $10,000 and $12,000.
They can't spend it.
That's right.
I mean, they know it's the right thing to do, and you can say it all day long, but you only have so many dollars in the budget.
Yeah.
But I said, you know, if these people could get that trap for less, if there was a subsidy, same thing they do. It got me thinking about it for like things you should do for your woods anyways, burning programs, spraying Kogan, all those kind of things through the NRCS. There's programs to incentivize for me to run burns through my woods.
Absolutely.
To spray things. They do things that you should be doing anyway, but might be out of your reach. Instead of money, you still have money in it, which means you're not going to abuse the thing or do whatever, but it makes it within the reach of somebody like me to be able to afford it.
Absolutely. I'm not going to spend $6,000 on a trap, you know.
Right.
But I'll spend $1,500 and I'll get two of them.
Yep. Yeah, that's
what I'll do.
Yeah, we'll get some of the state folks in to talk about that as well as we move forward. But that's a program out there. Yeah. We'll talk about how people can get signed up and do that.
Yeah, and I haven't been up the country, Sean, since about May. But my buddy up there,
you know what's happened? The hogs are so bad now. You hadn't been up there. They're in your trailer and they're in your bed.
Well, let me tell you, my buddy Jim Watson, I hunt with up there. He told me, he said, you would not believe the hogs. They are everywhere. You know, he's got that shooting lane out in front of his camp.
Yeah.
He says they're there all day long. He says they're just all – and up. He said up and down the dirt road that we go down, he said they got the road tore up. He says there's more hogs over there than he's ever seen.
Wow. And yeah, we will. We'll do a couple whole hog shows like we've done in the past because just – I like to hunt them. I like to see folks run dogs, and all, that's all fine. And we had in the river swamp, we had the single catch traps. Those are all good ways to get meat and have fun. You're never going to manage the hogs like that.
Nope, not like that. I mean, you're not.
I'm not against hunting them, not against turning dogs loose, all that stuff. I'm just saying, if you want to knock out the hogs, you got to do a real trapping program.
Yeah,
I mean, there's not everything else is for fun and for meat, and I want it to continue. But if you want to get rid of them, you got to do these.
You got to do these traps. Yeah. One thing Tony told me too that was interesting, real quick, is that you know, he says most people say, well, you put that trap out there and you catch half the herd, you know. Mm-hmm. Well, you might as well move the trap because they're not going to come back.
Yeah.
He says that's a lie.
Yeah.
He says he has seen them come back over and over and over and over again. He's been doing this for a long time. He says don't move your traps; you'll end up catching the other ones too.
All right, so we will do a in-depth dive on that in weeks to come on the show. Before we get to run to the break, and we're going to come back. Seth Maddox, waterfowl director for the state of Alabama, is going to join us, and we're going to talk about the May pond counts, which is the total volume of ducks migrating. You know, for a given year, this is how they assess how many ducks there are. Also, we'll get into Alabama's seasons. Got teal season starting a week later than normal. Also, in that discussion, sandhill cranes.
Yeah.
The ribeye of the sky.
Yeah.
Can hunt them now in Alabama, at least for, I think they're going to do 400 tags on that. We'll talk with him about that as well. He's going to join us in a little bit. Before we go any further, though, I want to say a couple things here. Number one, congratulations. Triton Graham, Huntley Dees, those boys. And I don't, you know, we call pretty much everybody, Mike and I know, boys, but these are boys. These are literally youngsters. Won the Bassmaster Federation's Junior Division World Championship. They were up on the Arkansas River. Not a Little Rock.
Never even knew they had such a thing, Sean. Did you know they had that?
I did not know they had the junior division.
I had no idea.
And good for Bassmaster. It's like the collegiate program, which I get so mad that didn't come around while I was in school at the University of Alabama.
I'd have went to college.
He could have fished.
Golly!
I mean, that would have been such a neat thing for folks like us in school, but that started years after. But not only the college programs, but now in the youth as well. The Bassmaster Federation's Junior Division World Championship. So two local boys out of Citradel, and I think they've got kinfolk that listen to the show. So congratulations pass along from us. Triton Graham, Huntley Dees, winning the Bassmaster Federation's Junior Division World Championship. They said, by the way, Dees said they caught the fish that won the team the tournament on the last cast of the day.
We got to get them on here, Tom.
We're trying to do that.
We got to get them on.
Right now, it's
them.
Been the problem is working around their school schedule to get an interview during the week. They said, it was the biggest fish caught in the tournament, and it felt great to lead them into victory on this. But Triton Graham, Huntley Dees, out of Citronel, way to go, boys, winning the Bassmaster Federation's Junior Division World Championship. All right.
More than awesome.
Yeah, good stuff. And also, while we're talking fish, if you didn't see the note earlier this week or check out our Facebook page, two more days of snapper season.
Yeah.
Labor Day weekend, Saturday and Sunday. I think it's August 31st. Yeah, August 31st and September 1st.
Yeah.
So you get those 2 days. Because we didn't know when we had the 5-day run there in earlier this month, in early August, we didn't know if we'd get those. And they compiled the numbers, looked at the data, and they can give us two more days. So we're getting two more days for Labor Day weekend. Pretty strong.
Hey, that's better than a poke in the eye.
Yes, well, those will be the fish that go directly into the vacuum sealer and get saved for this winter. So that is a deal. We'll talk more as we get right before the weekend of Labor Day about that on the show. All right, coming back, we're going to talk some birds. Seth Maddox, director of the waterfowl program for the state of Alabama, is going to join us. Yeah, not only we'll talk a little bit about the May pond counts and duck numbers for this year and what's being done in waterfowl management in the state, But Sandhill Cranes, first time they've been on the menu for Alabama hunters in my lifetime.
Whack and stack them.
You know, the ribeye in the sky, those big jokers.
Yep.
We'll talk about that and a whole lot more when we come back. Y'all stay close. It's FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Right, welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Sean Sullivan, Mike Ward. Glad to have you along. Remember, over on Facebook, facebook.com/FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Hit us up over there. Pictures, questions, comments. We get them over there. Put the podcast goes up after the show each Saturday. You can link through there. You can go to the FM Talk 106.5 website. Get it there as well. Yeah. Share it.
I want to thank Lee Davis, too, at G&D. Last week, that the party that he put on was just fantastic.
Yeah, he has a great party out there. And at the same time, you get a little advance chance to go ahead and book your fertilizer and seed and everything you need.
At a good price and have it all ready for you when you need it.
Yep. And then while you're doing that, eat some barbecue.
Oh, and ice cream.
And ice cream, yes, and ice cream. You didn't miss the ice cream for sure. But, yeah, big thank you to Lee. We'll talk to him more as we get closer to planting time, but that is not too far off. All right, I mentioned before we went to the break, he's been on the show with us before. It's always great to talk to Seth Maddox, Migratory Game Coordinator with the Alabama Department of Conservation and Natural Resources, as we talk about some waterfowl stories. Seth, thanks for being on.
Good morning, guys.
Hey, good morning.
Glad we can make it in this morning. Busy time of year for us.
Yeah, and can you, well, maybe you can believe, but a story that would be one that, like, you and I would talk about, okay? But this last week, I mean, all our local TV stations were talking about it. It made statewide news, local news, TV news, print news, and that is sandhill crane hunting in the state of Alabama. Did you realize it was going to be that big?
We probably knew some of it coming in because it's controversial. It even made national news.
So, it did make it. That's right. I did see it in a national sense, too.
That, yeah.
It's back. And, you know, one of the – like, we all get this, but I do 25 hours a week of non-outdoors show, and I try to explain to people, I said, the fact that the state is instituting a season for sandhill cranes is a positive story about the population recovery for sandhill cranes. Would you agree, Seth? I mean, that's the
100%,
story. 100%. I mean, that's a conservation story. Yeah. If we now have a season on them, that means y'all did something right.
That's right. Not just us. I mean, nationally. The population has been recovering. Early in the 20th century, a lot of species were well below their averages, their long-term averages. And so unregulated hunting took effect on most of those species, and since then, game laws have been passed to protect a lot of these species, and it's just taken sandhill cranes a lot longer to reestablish their population. But we've probably had huntable numbers since the 90s in the eastern U.S., but it just wasn't a big push for it at that time. But now that some states have taken it upon themselves to start some seasons, like Kentucky and Tennessee did, more and more states are probably going to start jumping on board here pretty soon.
I'm going to do something, audio cue for people that, I mean, maybe they can picture, and you Google sandhill cranes and maybe you've seen them before in your life, but you may have heard them and not known what you're hearing. And I'm going to play a little thing. Maybe you're sitting at a deer stand that came over driving.
Turkeys over there.
And you heard this. There's probably people now go, holy cow, I did hear that years ago. That's what that is, a sandhill crane. But, I mean, it's not common to the ears of Alabama hunters like a wood duck whistle or a mallard quack.
Yeah, it's a prehistoric species. They've been on this planet for millions of years. The earliest fossil record of sandhill cranes is 2.5 million years ago in Florida. And with that, man has been hunting them for thousands of years since they've been in North America. So this is not, it's new in the sense that in the common or the modern era of Alabama hunting that we're opening a season, but they've been hunted for thousands of years before this.
Yeah, and you're talking about Florida and the Southeast, and then again, I think about hunting sandhill cranes in more of a Western mentality, and I think there's even pictographs out in the Southwest where they hunted them out there.
Yeah, cave paintings and stuff like that. And the population recovered in the mid-continent well before the eastern population became huntable. They've been hunting cranes in the Central Flyway since 1961. So it's not really anything new. There's, you know, 16 states and Canadian provinces that have opened sandhill crane seasons now.
Kind of give us a little bit of a primer here on sandhill cranes, like breeding areas, migration areas, those kind of things. I mean, you're talking about Central Flyway. Here we are talking about the Mississippi Flyway. What about the Atlantic Flyway? Kind of break it down for us.
Yeah, there's six recognized subpopulations across the U.S., across North America. In the east of the Mississippi River, it's known as the eastern population. They are the greater subspecies of sandhill cranes, so that's the largest subspecies. These birds stand 5 feet tall, have a 6-foot wingspan, weigh anywhere from 8 to 12 pounds. And so they breed in southern Canada and the northern tier states along the Canadian border. And they migrate down during the wintertime through the Mississippi and Atlantic Flyway from, you know, areas of like Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, coming down through the center of the flyway through Indiana, Kentucky, Tennessee, Alabama, Georgia, and then a lot of them end up in Florida.
So, let's talk about the breeding area in the northern tier and in Canada. Are they looking at like the prairie pothole, like waterfowl? What kind of areas they use to breed?
Yeah, some of that area. You know, they're ground nesters. They don't nest in trees, so they need open ground. They don't like a lot of overhead cover. So any type of open wetland area, you know, they want to be near water. And so yeah, any type of that. They're in the north. They do have a lot of agricultural fields, and they get a lot of agricultural damage from these birds. So there is a depredation order permit available for them up there, and they do take advantage of that up there because they are causing so much agricultural damage up there. You know, the population has continued to grow and expand in the eastern population. We're probably over 100,000 birds now. The last fall index count was 97,000, but that's not 100% count. So they're starting to spread out, go to historical ranges and spread out their range, and so they're causing more problems in those northern tier states, and we want our hunters to be able to take advantage of this resource. This is in a sustainable nature, and harvest some and be able to eat them.
Okay, yeah.
You know, this, I assume one of the reasons that we're going to have a season is something like with the geese. The geese really kind of become a nuisance down here. They came down here and started living down here, not going back home.
And those are turned out here.
Yeah, that's partially our fault.
Yeah, that's people turned out the non-migratories.
Well, yeah, but
those big B-52s. Well,
yeah,
Seth can correct it if it's.
Is that right? I mean, I don't.
Yeah, it's similar to that, but not quite to that expanse yet. I mean, they are a nuisance, but their population is not anywhere close to what Canada geese populations are. It's not. We didn't open season just because they're a nuisance in some areas. We opened the season because, I mean, biologically, there's no reason not to open the season.
Yeah.
We can sustainably harvest these birds, and the population will still continue to grow. So we want our hunters to be able to take advantage of something that that can sustain a hunting season.
Yeah, I want to get into it. So we talked about the breeding grounds. Where do they like to winter? I mean, because I'm a guy that spent a lot of time in duck blinds and Mobile 10 Salt Delta and seen a lot of, you know, extra ducks you don't normally see or shot geese in the Delta over the years. I don't know, maybe one time heard a crane. I've never seen them in the Delta. Not that I can remember.
Yeah, in Alabama, they typically overwinter in the Tennessee River Valley. So along the Tennessee River there in North Alabama, along Weiss Lake, on the Coosa River. They typically just hit that northern, third tier of Alabama. And we have a lot that overwinter there in Alabama at the Wheeler National Wildlife Refuge and on our state refuges there in Jackson County and on our waterfowl management areas in North Alabama. And the ones that are just passing through, continuing migration, you know, they just hit that northern third of the state, and they continue through Georgia down to Florida.
Are they using marsh? Are they using ag fields? Are they using moist soil? Where do they, when they pick a place to stay overnight or stay for the remainder of the winter, where are they going?
All of the above, but it's typically shallow water areas, moist soil, ag fields, and, you know, managed agricultural units and waterfowl areas. What we see is that they typically roost in shallow water in large flocks, and during the day they will disperse and go to these agricultural fields and feed on unharvested grain.
I mean, so they're eating seed and grain and those kind of things. They're not, because you would look at them as a crane and people would think around here, well, that looks like a blue heron or that looks like an egret. They're a fish eater.
Right. Yeah, and so they have a similar stature to those other birds, and a lot of people get, you know, call them all cranes, but they're not related at all. Sandhill cranes are pretty omnivorous; they'll eat anything, but they typically eat small grains. That's the majority of their diet. Whereas, you know, your blue herons or your egrets, they're fish eaters, and so that probably plays into the fact that it's a consumable.
It's a tasty, right. It's a, yeah. That's how a scientist says it. A consumable natural resources. An old boy like me will say, y'all, there's some good eating out here.
For sure, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's probably one of the best tasting migratory birds out there. I've never eaten it, but that's what I hear from most people that have. If you've ever eaten a white-fronted goose or a speck, it's probably one of the top ones, but I hear it's better than that.
That has a whole side discussion I would like to talk about. But y'all, what do they call them, Seth? What's the nickname?
Ribeye the Sky.
Ribeye the Sky.
So I mean, that tells you people like I'm interested in eating when I've heard these stories over time that they're so good to eat. And we talk about specklebelly. I'm going to take 1 minute from this discussion. Specklebellies. I love eating specklebellies. I have a tough time eating snows. I have hunted them where the specks and the snows are working the same fields over and over again, but the specks taste good and the snows don't. Now, Seth, why?
Well, it's just how they process that food and they're just metabolism and bodily makeup, you know. They just process that grain a little differently, and so the meat tastes just a little bit different.
Yeah, it's because I've always told my buddies, if I ever have somebody on the show that knows this kind of stuff, I'm going to ask that question, because we have argued that back and forth in a pit over the years. Said, why they're eating the same dang things? Does one taste so much better? All right, we're going to run the break. We're coming right back. More of this discussion about sandhill cranes and hunting and how that's going to work with the permit draw in the state of Alabama. And also get into some duck talk. May pond counts. What are we looking at for the fall migration as we continue our conversation with Seth Maddox with the state and waterfowl coordinator for the state of Alabama. As we continue right here on FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Sean Sullivan, Mike Ward, the big winner from the event the other night.
Yeah, how about that?
Always win. Always the hot hand on those things. And talking to migratory game coordinator for the state of Alabama, Seth Maddox, joining us to talk a handful of things. First of all, we talked sandhill cranes. And break down for us, now that we're going to have a season, how that's done. It's a tag thing, and how does it work?
Yeah, so we're only allowed to take a certain quota each year out of the population, and so we are doing a limited quota draw. So we're going to draw 400 hunters. Each hunter will get a permit, and then each hunter will get 3 tags per their permit. So we'll with a total maximum harvest of 1,200 birds. So once we'll have the registration process beginning here in September. Looks like we're going to try to open that on September the 4th, and it'll be open through the 25th on our website at outdooralabama.com. And then as soon as we close that down, we'll have the drawing, computer-controlled drawing, in early October there.
And you had mentioned some of it, but we're not exactly a hot spot for sandhill cranes down here in southwest Alabama. So help folks once again on public grounds in the state of Alabama. Someone was down here, wanted to get in the drawing. Are there sandhill cranes on public grounds somewhere in the state where somebody could go hunt them?
Sure, yeah. And so the hunting zone is only in the northern third part of the state. So from I-20 at the Georgia state line to Birmingham, and then I-22 to the Mississippi state line. Everything north of that, so pretty much north of Birmingham. So the public areas, we see them in North Alabama. In extreme northeast Alabama, we have the Jackson County waterfowl areas. They hang out in those areas. In the center part of the state, we have Swan Creek and Mallard Fox Creek. They hang out around there, and Wheeler's right across the river from there, where a majority of the birds hang out. And then anywhere along the Tennessee River, it's all public access. All that's owned by TVA. A lot of the land there is open to hunting, just open permit public land. On the Coosa River, it's owned by Alabama Power. You can't get out on the bank, but you can hunt them from the boat. So there'll be a lot of public land access for these birds.
Good deal. Let's talk about some other waterfowl here, too, as we look forward to the 2019-2020 season. May pond counts. How are the numbers looking? What's the fall migration looking like?
All that stuff hasn't been published yet. It's not quite out yet, so you probably haven't likely seen it anywhere.
That's right. I've been looking.
From insider talk, it's looking pretty good. There's a lot of wet areas, but there's some dry areas. But some of those dry areas probably needed to dry up to regenerate. But the prairies overall looking pretty good. I think the water looks good. So I think the numbers are going to be probably on average for this time of year, for this year. So I expect a pretty good fall flight.
We're probably still looking at 660. I mean, looking at the maximum.
It'll be 6 ducks a day for 60 days. Yeah, we'll have a six duck 60-day season this coming season. You know, we set those seasons over a year in advance now, so I'm about to go to the flyway meeting next week, and we'll already be setting seasons and bag limits for the next season. So we're already working, looking forward to next season before the season even gets started.
You know, there's y'all break that down. I guess when you do that, you're looking at what the conditions in the breeding grounds are now and projecting that forward a year, or how do you work that?
Yeah, that's correct. We're looking at what the conditions are like now. You know, the harvest from last year. The number of birds available in the population, and all that goes into these models. It's a modeling system and adaptive harvest management, and we throw all that into these models, and it predicts what the flight's going to look like, and what the population is going to look like for the next year. And so not much changes year to year. I mean, we've had a long-term stability in this system. You know, the long-term average for most duck species is really high, and so we've had over 25 years of stable regulations and seasons. You only see a few species that change bag limits every year, usually the pintail, every once in a while, canvasbacks. So yeah, we're in pretty stable regulations, and we're working towards some different regulations, doing some different things, and we may have. In the future, here in the next few years, we may have some different bag limits and stuff that maybe we may can increase harvest on some of these species. So we look forward to going through that process and seeing what we can offer the hunters in the future.
Yeah, and Seth, I want to pick your brain on some of the species that make a bigger difference down here than others. Obviously, the nation at all is focused on the mallard count, right? I mean, that's a big driver, but obviously along the Gulf Coast, we're talking about the gray duck or the gadwall is a big deal. And I want to get into how we're looking for gadwall numbers. Also looking at teal numbers. And then I want to find out about, you mentioned some of the ducks that move back and forth in numbers, you know, like pintails and canvasbacks. What about mottled ducks? And what does y'all's research show with mottled duck population here in southwest Alabama? I'll let you say it because I have just anecdotal, you know.
Yeah, mottled ducks have been on a decline in the Gulf for several years now. There's been some problems in several states with inbreeding with feral mallards, and then just loss of habitat in general. I think loss of habitat is probably the biggest driving factor for most of them, but you combine that with some feral mallard inbreeding, and you've got a problem there. So, you know, with some weather changes, some sea level rise, a loss of wetland habitat, it's a big concern right now for the mottled duck population, and that's one that we may not have a hunting season on for too much longer. If you look at the long term trends on those on that species, so I would get out and take advantage of it now. But you know, we're doing a lot. We're trying to purchase and enhance all the land we can in that area, so that we can, you know, try to bolster that species. And they're doing the same thing in all the Gulf states.
So is the habitat the limiting factor, or is it because, you know, I wonder if you could enhance the population with additional ducks. And I'm not a guy that likes to put, you know, pen-raised critters out for sure. But I mean, if you're looking at an issue with a species that's declining that strongly, if you can get the habitat, could you enhance the population, try to get it to restart? Or
habitat's the biggest factor. I mean, you know, we never really want to try to reintroduce birds into the population because there's a lot of things that go along with that, disease and inbreeding and other stuff that we can cause a bigger impact on, a bigger negative impact on than just creating the habitat. But really it's a loss of freshwater marsh. You know, these ducks need that freshwater marsh to live their life. And, I mean, you know, Louisiana is losing, you know, feet of, you know, acres, several thousand of acres every year to encroachment by the sea level. And same thing in Texas and Florida. I mean, it's happening in Alabama, too. So we don't have as big a population of mottled ducks that are residents as those other states. But, you know, any kind of freshwater marsh loss from saltwater intrusion is definitely a loss. And so that's the biggest factor that influences mottled ducks right now. So if we're able to, you know, sustain those freshwater marshes along the coast, then that's going to really bolster the population.
I would really worry about how hard that would be. Let's say that you do have to curtail or stop the mottled duck harvest. Maybe it's not as big a deal here because it's only, you know, once in a blue moon right down on, you know, here in the south end of the flyway that we get mallards. I mean, we do get them, but it's not that common. But I'm thinking like Texas Gulf Coast and all that. I mean, I've seen people misidentify a mottled duck as a teal before, let alone you start mixing in a place where you got hen mallards and people are shooting them for hen mallards and it ends up being mottled ducks.
Yeah, it definitely would happen. But I mean, it's not even in like Louisiana on the coast where most of your mottled ducks are, they still don't get a whole lot of mallards. And so there would probably be a big campaign, advertising campaign going on to try to educate the public on what to look for and what not to look for and what to shoot and what not to shoot. So it's definitely a strong implications on that. But, it's something that's probably going to have to be done here in the next 5 or 10 years to look at that.
I hate to hear that because they are a neat duck for us coastal hunters. It's, you know, one of our big ducks. Let's talk about gray ducks or gadwalls. Let's talk about how they – do you have any sneak information or from what you're seeing from the prairies, can you make a deduction how that flight's going to look?
It should look good. They've been well above their long-term average for a long time, 20-plus years. So I don't foresee anything changing there. I think that should be average or better. I don't think there's any concern about gadwall populations overall. They're starting to expand ranges, show up in areas where they historically haven't shown up. And, it's a really important species here in Alabama, not only for the Delta, but for North Alabama as well. It's one of our bigger ducks that get harvested. So, it's really important. And we have some research going on right now for those in North Alabama, looking at hunter disturbance and stuff. So it'll be interesting to get the results of that. And, long term, I don't see any change on gadwall for a while. There's no concerns for them.
All right, with time in mind here, I'm going to jump to the first species, waterfowl species we get to hunt. That's blue-winged teal coming up next month. Let's talk about the flight on those, and let's talk about September 14th. Now we're talking, Seth. Now we're talking. Starting,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah. So flight's looking good for those. Long-term average on teal have just exploded across the prairies and their breeding grounds, and so there's tons of teal to take advantage of. We got some feedback from hunters and started looking at some the migration dates and stuff, and so we decided to push the season back a week this year and try to catch the end of that migration a little more, and maybe there will be more here in state. So it's something we like to listen to hunters, get some hunter feedback, and put that out there to see what happens.
Well, I tell you,
16 days.
Yeah, and that's for people who don't know. So you got 16 days, and before we've started the weekend around the 7th, right in close. But I tell you, as a coastal hunter, I am beyond happy with moving it forward a week, getting that September 14th start, because I just – and sure, this will be the year that we get some early cold weather. It's going to come through. But day in and day out, the later we go into teal season, the better the hunting gets. So to have it a week later, ending a week later, I think it's going to be a big deal.
Yeah, we used to try to catch migration for all of the state because, a lot of hunters, want to hunt in North Alabama and in Central Alabama and South Alabama. We try to catch that migration, but, trying something different never hurts. We may try this for two or three years and look at averages, average harvest across those, compare it to previous years, and, see what happens. Looking at the data, this may be a permanent fixture for us, or it may not, depending on what the data tells us. But something we want to try out for a few years and see if it increases harvest for us.
I'm dating myself on how long I've been hunting ducks in the state of Alabama, but we used to have split zones in the state.
Yeah.
Used to take that into account. Any idea, any of that starting? Because I don't want the guy in North Alabama because I want it to end as late as it can. Right. I don't want to mess the guy. I also say, okay, I want to be fair to the guy in North Alabama who may get teal 2 weeks before we get teal down here. Is there any discussion of maybe splitting it up into tiers or something like that?
No, they don't actually allow us to have statewide, or we don't have any splits in this season, in that season.
For teal.
It's a statewide thing. You only get those 16 days. You can't spread it out amongst zones or anything like that.
Because if you're a flat state like Tennessee, you got it made. But if you're a long state like Alabama, it's
right. But I think what we'll see is, they're typically pushed through the state pretty quick, but I think we'll catch a majority of them during one of these weeks of the season here. We're just pushing it back a week, so it's we'll see what happens and go from there. We'll make an informed decision on whether we need to keep it like it was or move it to like it is. So, but we did this because of hunter feedback, and we want to see what happens. Not only feedback from Delta hunters or South Alabama hunters, but feedback from North Alabama hunters too. So we'll see what happens.
All right, good stuff. Okay, one last. We got a minute left here, but I gotta get you to tell folks. I hate to do this because I feel like I'm shooting myself in the foot, but I want to be fair. SOAs for waterfowl in the state. Talk to people about what's on the docket, how they get signed up to hunt some of these state special opportunity areas.
Yeah, so we'll be opening those up here pretty soon, probably in September. Our registration is online at outdooralabama.com, just similar to how you'll sign up for the Sandhill Crane Hunt. We have these special opportunity areas where they're not open to the general public hunting. You have to sign up and register, and there'll be a draw process. So we're limiting the hunter pressure on these areas so that we have good quality hunts on those areas. We're working towards adding more of these opportunities in Alabama. So it's hard to find these large continuous tracts of acreage where we can purchase and open up to general public hunting. We're able to purchase smaller tracts, 1,000 acres, 500 acres here and there, and open those up to small hunts. It can't sustain pressure of general public hunting. Open gate hunting. It needs some type of management, hunter management on it. And so these opportunities will provide quality hunts to the lucky people that get drawn to do so.
That's an understatement. Some of the pictures I've seen and the mallards, nice mallard strap with black ducks on it and stuff. Oh, my gosh, that made me jealous. All right, Seth, as always, man, we appreciate your time. Thanks for coming on with us.
Thanks for the time, guys. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Seth.
All right, Seth Maddox, waterfowl coordinator for the state of Alabama. As we get ready for, teal season coming up next month, and, of course, moving on into the end of November when big duck season gets cranked up. And Sandhill Cranes, ribeye of the sky, 400 of us will get a tag to be able to go shoot three of them. All I ask for is one side of just a breast.
You want to try that?
Oh, my gosh.
Steak in the sky.
Ribeye of the sky? Yeah. Forget about it. I'm on for that. All right, coming right back. All right, welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Big thank you to Seth Maddox, waterfowl coordinator for the state of Alabama. And we'll talk to him again in October, November as we get closer to big duck season. And we'll be on the other side of teal season. But yeah, so teal season's always been started on the weekend of the 7th, right, thereabouts. You know, yeah. Some years it's 5th, 6th. The weekend is like the second Saturday of the month. Not Labor Day.
You're a big duck hunter.
Yes.
I mean, are you happy with that?
Very happy.
Okay. Good.
Very happy. Because I want it to start later, because there's been a lot of times there's just not a lot of ducks in the Delta.
But they are a little bit later on.
Yeah. And then you'll go back out there. Often what happens, I'll go back out there, start to look for speckled trout and redfish, you know, for fall fishing right after, you know, at the end of September, beginning of October. Then there's a pile.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's like anything we've talked about in migration. And this is true in anything that migrates. But for ducks, it's a bell curve. There's some, you know, we were talking off the air with Seth. I've seen blue-winged teal in the Delta as early as July 5th. That's been maybe 20 years ago I saw that, but I've seen ducks in July, you know, and then there's teal that come in with the mallards on into cold winter. But the bulk of them, the bell curve, the biggest belly of it, is sometime in the month of September through early October. And that's what we're trying to take advantage of. So, and they're a fun duck to hunt. You know, you get a generous limit here. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Do identify your ducks out there, though. I mean, they're blue-winged teal. You know, those other ones that sound like wood ducks that aren't blue, they're wood ducks. And the season is not open for them.
Yeah, well, so they don't sound like the teal?
Yeah.
They're not teal.
No, some people call them rainbow teal instead of rainbow-winged teal. But no, easy on the wood ducks. We'll have a chance to shoot them, but, you know, make sure it's for blue-winged teal only.
Yeah.
But enjoy that. And they're good eating, and it's a lot of fun, and getting back out. I mean, it's just getting back out hunting this next month is too much fun. Alligator season going on right now. This is the last weekend of gator season. I've seen some decent gators coming in, and they got the new coastal zone. They kill one down and maybe more, but the one I saw, they did maybe it made Fox 10, or somebody had it on their website, or maybe the state did, but I think it was Fox 10. They kill one down at Fort Morgan in this coastal zone.
I saw that.
And so
it's actually in salt water, wasn't it?
Yeah, and there are, heck, how many times, I mean, what was a picture I put up a couple years ago? I was coming in from snapper fishing and had to dodge one, so I didn't hit it, and it was right off Fort Morgan.
Yeah.
I mean, physically off Fort Morgan in the mouth of the bay. Yeah. And they're off the front of it. I mean, you know, from time to time.
There's a bunch of pictures last year of one in around Dolphin Island, around the bridge.
Yeah, so, I mean, they do that as they're moving, but obviously they're not going to stay there. But there, you think about all the coastal marsh there, Fort Morgan, all that stuff on the north side of Fort Morgan Peninsula, all those little sloughs go back there and all that. That's good habitat for them.
Yeah.
And then they opened up this coastal zone, which is pretty much everything south of I-10 down to the coast. So that's an area that has not gotten hunted as much. Even though the way I understood it before, I must have misunderstood it. I thought that was all encompassed inside the Mobile Tensaw Zone. But I think what they did is added additional tags and made a new zone.
Yeah.
You know, so they split it up, more chances for people to get drawn. So.
What's the biggest one this year? Do you know?
Yeah, they had an 11-footer. But it was an 11-footer gator. It's a great gator. I remember in reading it, I don't have the story in front of me. I read it and it was like, it couldn't have been a female at 11 feet, but it was not a heavy gator. It was 380 pounds or something like that for 11 feet. Usually, the females are going to be a lot lighter.
Yeah,
they're just not. You know, you get those when you start getting those 700 pound gators, that kind of stuff. That usually 600, 500. Those are bulls. Usually those are males. Even if the length, you know what I'm saying. If you put, okay, let's get something reasonable. If you put a 9-foot male gator next to a 9-foot female gator, that bull gator will weigh sometimes almost twice as much as a female. They're just stockier. I don't know. They're just bigger in weight. But I think 11-foot was the longest I had seen. That's not for sure. I haven't checked every area and what came in, but that's what's off the top of my head.
Usually Miller's Ferry area
is
the one that kills.
That's where the record is, right?
Yeah.
1,100 pounds.
Usually kill the biggest one every year, about.
And so. You know what's interesting too is the nature of all of us that would go out wanting to kill the biggest gator possible. Not the biggest one is what this season's weird. It's making no impact on the population.
Yeah.
Now it's taking out big gators, which is which is good. You get big gators could be problems and all that, taking out the big gators, but just the way the population dynamics work for alligators, you take out that one, there's another one gets to live and fills in. You know, it's very similar to if you only killed 5.5-year-old or 6.5-year-old or older bucks on your property, you would never change the population of it.
Nope.
And that's kind of what we're doing
it
with gators.
It wouldn't hurt it at all.
Nope.
That's right.
All right. Prep Sports Report on the way next. We got to get out of here. We'll see you next week.
See you next week.